While we're talking about that, before I forget, a lot of people were asking me last minute saying, hey, when, what's the schedule? Like, when are you going to offer the rest of these things? Am I going to have to wait till 2016 to hear the stunning conclusion of Manicotti and State? No, the plan right now is we're going to do the second and third legs of the series in calendar 2011. We don't know exactly when. I mean, there'll be a little bit of a break so we can all recuperate after each session, as it were. But the plan is not to leave you hanging. So, of course, we'll let you know once we have finalized that. But that's the idea, is to go through it fairly quickly, but leave some space in between each one so we don't get overwhelmed. Why don't I go ahead and move through this slide here. Another thing before I forget, as far as this environment, so bear with us. We're starting a few minutes late. This is the first time I've been using this environment. Before, I was using DimDim. So this is a lot better. It's a lot more powerful. It's a little bit counterintuitive when you first start using this, but believe me, there's tons of advantages to doing this compared to the DimDim, not least of which is people have not been reporting the freezing. So if you've had classes with me before, you know one of the problems was that there would be interruptions because the video would freeze up. Apparently that doesn't happen with this approach. The other huge benefit is I'll be able to switch to a whiteboard and draw, and you can see in real time, or almost real time, there's a bit of a delay, me drawing diagrams as if it were on a whiteboard. And so when we get to the various diagrams and things later on in the book, that's going to be invaluable as compared to just showing you static snapshots of a PowerPoint slide. One more thing that Danny wanted me to mention to you. So some of this is going to be repetition, but again, if you have a technical issue while you're listening to the lecture, if all of a sudden you can't hear me or something, don't put it in the Q&A. We're never going to use the Q&A in this, just because it's going to get too confusing. So never use that. You just use the chat. And then you can see you have an option where it says send to. And so the default there should probably be all participants. Did you want to say something? What? Okay, so I stand corrected. So anyway, yeah, so the chat sometimes gets going crazy. So anyway, again, if you have a technical issue in the midst of a lecture, email Danny there, because, you know, the last thing in the world you want to do is email me, because I'm not going to see it until the class is over, because I'm not checking my email while I'm talking to you guys. Okay, so why don't we jump in then to the main lecture itself. So here's a rough outline of what we're doing tonight and how the course works. Some of you who took my principles class, you'll see some of these slides I recycle, and that's simply because to do the principles textbook, I was relying on Rothbard. So some of this introductory material, it's the same stuff. And so that's why you're going to see some of these slides will look familiar to those of you who took my principles of economics class. All right, so for how the course works, I think most of you have had me before, so I'll keep this really brief. Similar framework from previous courses, lectures on Wednesdays, and then on Saturdays we'll have office hours that will be typically an hour, where, you know, not mandatory, just if you want to tune in. And it's going to be at varying times, both to cater to people in different time zones, and also because my son plays soccer and his games are all at different times, so I can't just set aside an hour on Saturday. So for those, I will tell you usually by the Thursday before when it's going to be, so you can plan if you want to show up to that. And that's just a free for all. People just tune in and ask me questions, and that's all we do there. Also, there will be a topic in the Moodle forums for questions for the professor for each week. So you can post them there either before or after, and I'll try to stay current with those, because I'm not going to be able to get to all your questions at the lecture time itself. What I do typically for on the Wednesday lectures is I try to do it an hour. Sometimes it spills over, and then I switch for the remaining half hour, whatever it is, and cater to your questions. Just to let you guys know, big picture, I can't cover everything. Even just this introductory thing, I thought, okay, we only did 33 pages. surely I can just go through and hit every little thing. And I couldn't, because Rothbard, he just, you know, he covers a lot of material. It's deceptive. He writes so clearly, you would think that, you know, he spends a lot of pages talking about one thing, but it's, he does it very succinctly. And so he actually covers a lot of stuff. So there's, in my lectures, I can't cover everything. So if you're having trouble about a particular little point that I don't mention in the lecture, by all means, post your question under the questions for the professor in that week, and I'll try to get to that, if not that night, but later on. Every week you'll have multiple choice quizzes, and those will be open for a full week. And when we blast out the email, we will be very clear about that, so you don't need to be writing stuff down right now, just to give you the big picture. And then we'll have a final exam at the end of the course. Okay, and of course, that's all up to you. You don't have to take the course for credit if you don't want to. One more thing in terms of strategy, some people are emailing me. You will get there's like three tiers of this. The way to get the most out of the course is to read Rothbard's textbook beforehand, or text beforehand, right? So that whatever material we're covering, if you could read Rothbard in the original, that whole thing, before you hear my lecture, you'll get the most out of it. If you don't have enough time to do that, but you have a little bit of time, then at least read that relevant portion from my study guide. And then failing that, it's still going to be okay if you just listen to my lectures. They're self-contained, in other words. I'm not going to just say, hey, remember that thing on page 50? Well, this is what he meant. That's not the way I'll do the lecture. The lecture could stand on its own, but obviously you won't get as much out of it. And it'd be better, if you were going to do the reading, it's better to do the reading beforehand and then hear my lecture, as opposed to hearing the lecture and then trying to do the reading. Okay, well, I think that's all you guys need to know, since, like I say, many of you are repeat students. So why don't we jump right in here. Obviously, the big thing going on in this introductory chapter, and we're really only looking at the first half of the chapter, is human action. And that's the title of Mises' famous book. And I don't know about you guys, but when I was younger and was in high school, actually, I got into Austrian economics, and I eagerly ordered Mises' book, and I waited for it in the mail. I was still halfway through the book and wondering, why did he call it human action? Why didn't he just call it economics? I totally missed that. All right. And so, but now it's, I understand why they're doing that. All right. So what is the big deal with human action? Why is that so important? It's because that's the way Mises chose to ground economics, right? That was the foundation he gave to it. So he didn't just look at it as, oh, we're studying money, or we're studying commerce, or even we're studying the economy. Mises and then Rothbard, of course, liked the approach and followed it and tried to build it up and systematize it even more. Mises was saying that what economics is a subset of this broader study of human action. Okay, and he used the term praxeology for that. So that term, I think I define it a little bit later on, but I'll just, so it's okay if I repeat myself. So praxeology, what does that mean? You guys have heard that term thrown around. Praxeology is the study of, or the science of, human action. So what we do in praxeology is we study scientifically, if you will, the implications of this idea of human action. And so what does that have to do with economics? Well, economics is a subset of praxeology. Okay, so praxeology, strictly speaking, is broader than economics. And we can imagine studying things that are not economics, but yet fall within praxeology. And some philosophers and others have made modest attempts to do that. But that's the idea. So Mises, sort of in retrospect, you know, he studied economics. He knew a bunch of things about economics. He studied the work of Karl Menger. And then Mises was trying to give a big picture, what the heck is economics? And so he comes up with this idea of praxeology and then puts economics within it and calls it the best developed branch of praxeology. Okay, so to understand action then, this is going to be basic to a lot of you, but I really want to hammer this home, because if you don't get this, all this stuff is going to be over your head. And I didn't really get this until I went to Auburn and heard Guido Holzmann give a lecture on this, and that was when it really clicked with me, okay, that we talk about action, the distinction is between purposeful action and mindless behavior. Okay, so a lot of people, they use the term action and behavior interchangeably, and they think that, oh yeah, action, you know, human action, what is that? That's a weird term, but that just means people's bodily movements, right? That people are moving around, that's human action, there you go. No, that's not what it is. Okay, so human action, purposeful action, what it means is goal-directed behavior. So it's not just about the physical thing that you're seeing. It's not just the physical event, as it were. It involves attributing motivations. Okay, so, and this gets a little bit philosophical, but that's the whole point. That's where Mises is coming from, because Mises is very philosophical. And this is why, if you read the work of Hans Hoppe, you will understand the Austrian, or I should say the Misesian approach to economics and human action better, because Hoppe is, you know, trained in philosophy, and so he comes at it from that angle. So the point here is that it involves what you may know as dualism. Okay, so the idea is it's not just the physical material world, it's not just atoms and molecules. To be able to identify something as human action, there is a mental component to it that you can't see. It's intangible. Okay, it's, you can't just look at something and say, oh, that's human action, and because I measured it. You have to sort of get into the head of somebody else, right? So there's a lot of different ways of illustrating this. One way that I like with students to do it is, just because they like graphic examples, is relying on Hayek's article. So if you noticed it in Man, Economy, and State, when Rothbard starts out talking about human action, he's got a footnote to Hayek's article, The Facts, and Facts is like in quotation marks, of the Social Sciences, something like that. I might have a few words off, but that's what he's talking about. If you have time and you're interested in this stuff, I highly encourage you to go read that article. And in there, Hayek makes the point that, you know, there are certain things that, to classify certain objects, you need to know the intentions, the subjective intentions of the people using them, even to just get started. So he gives the example of to say something is a weapon, right? That's not an attribute of the object itself. You can't just look at something and say, oh, well, it weighs this much. It's you know, it's got this kind of sharpness, or this, you know, these physical properties, therefore it is a weapon. That no, to be a weapon necessarily involves somebody else's, some thinking being's conscious designs or plans or purposes, okay? To give you an exaggerated example, just to make sure you're following me here. So if I'm teaching a class and then I see a student have a pen and is walking, and then all of a sudden puts the pen into some other kid's eye, well, was that pen a weapon? You don't know. You need to know more information, right? And to figure out whether the pen was a weapon, you wouldn't ask, well, what was the pen made out of? You wouldn't say, well, did the other kid get really hurt? You know, is he going to be blinded, or did he just get, you know, a temporary? Those would be irrelevant. To figure out, was that pen a weapon in that historical event right there, you would need to know the kid who was holding the pen, what was he trying to do with it? So if he was just walking and hit, you know, some water that was on the ground that he didn't see and slipped, and it was just a freak thing, then the pen wasn't a weapon. It was just, you know, a horrible accident. But if, you know, he found out that guy stole his girlfriend or something, and he was really mad, and he grabs a pen and runs over there, I mean, well, then it's a weapon. Okay, so my point with that sort of silly example is just to underscore that even, and this is what Hayek was getting at, even to get started, to get off the ground in the social sciences, you need to come to the situation with some theories about how the world works and how people are and what motivates them, okay, that you can't. You might think, if you're just real empirical and what's called a positivist, you might think, well, no, we don't want to assume anything. Let's let the facts speak for themselves. You know, we'll just do a bunch of regressions. We'll collect some data, and we don't want to go in with a closed mind. We want to be open to all sorts of theories. And Hayek and Mises and others in the Austrian tradition point out that you're fooling yourself if you think you can do that, that you necessarily come to the social sciences already equipped to analyze the world in a certain way, And that one of the things we do, and a lot of times we don't even, it's so automatic, we don't even realize we're doing it, is we say that we interpret events attributing motives to other conscious beings with goals. And that's a fundamental part of what we do in the social sciences. And so that's what human action is. So this distinction, purposeful action versus mindless behavior, on the one hand, it's real obvious. Things like a guy who's trying to get a job promotion, he's engaging in purposeful action, and a boulder that's rolled off a cliff and is falling, well, we wouldn't say the boulder is trying to get to the ground, or we wouldn't say the boulder is trying to get to a lower altitude, or the boulder is trying to reach the center of mass of planet Earth, right? That's not the way scientists talk anymore. That strikes us as primitive to attribute motivations to just matter, okay? But yet, if the matter is composing a human body, well, then a lot of times we do talk like that, right? Because we could, just as physicists or chemists, blandly describe a murder scene or a guy going to a job interview. You know, we could make a bunch of true statements about the cells in the guy's body and how they're obeying various biological and chemical laws, and they would be, right? But the point is, as social observers, we might also say, oh, he's trying to get a job interview, and that's why he's saying what good skills he has, or that's why when they asked him, why did you leave your last job, he tried to dodge the question, right? You see, we automatically just start using language about another conscious being's motivations, and we don't talk like that in the natural sciences. We don't say, I mean, sometimes you loosely do, especially if it's biology, but even there, that's because biology is living things, and so it's hard to talk about other living things without attributing motives to them. Okay, why don't I move on, but we'll be coming back to this point. Okay, so part of what I'm stressing here is that action is a viewpoint. And what I mean is, it's a viewpoint for the observer, for the social scientist, for the economist, for the purposes of our class. Right, that we are going to choose to interpret events by saying there are motivations going on. Okay, so give you an example that's somewhat economic or commercial, you see someone walk up to another person, and then, you know, I'm trying to blandly describe it, and then his muscles in his right arm contract and expand, so that his hand is plunged into his right pocket, and then similar processes happen, and then the fingers grasp this rectangular green piece of paper, and then it extends it, and then the other guy, you know, does a similar thing, and it contracts muscles and so forth to grasp it, and the other first person lets go, and then the first person takes a bottle of H2O and then walks out of the store, okay? So you could use lots of different ways to describe that, and chemists could say one thing and physicists could say another and so on. But as economists, we're going to say, oh, that guy just bought a bottle of water, and there was an exchange that just happened there. And you could start talking about that, but the only way you could do it is to get inside the mind of the people. And that's an important thing. And the mind is different from the brain. And we're not talking about the physical, you know, cerebrum and cerebellum and all that stuff. When we say, what's that person doing, what we're talking about an intangible, what does he want to do? Okay, so here, you know, you don't have to take a stand on whether things are ultimately determined by material forces. And, you know, Mises talks about that in Human Action. We're not taking a stand on that interesting debate. We're just saying, for right now, we don't really know exactly what makes one human being's body do one thing and another one do another thing. It looks to us as if people have free will, and it looks like they choose to do things. And so we're going to take that as one of the starting points for our analysis of human action, that people have goals that they are trying to achieve. Okay, so again, well, if we're going to look at an event and start using the term action or the language of action, it's because we're saying, beyond the surface appearance here of the physical things going on, we are assuming something else. We're assuming that there is another thinking, conscious being whose mind is at work, that's using reason to try to achieve ends that that thing subjectively values. Okay, and so as we go through the lecture, you'll see there's a lot packed into that simple observation. Okay, some of this we've already covered, but Rothbard makes a bunch of points, and I just want to stress some of them. So just a few definitions here. So praxeology, again, is the study of human action, or sometimes it's called the science of human action. And to repeat myself, economics is just a branch of praxeology, or a subset of praxeology. Means, in the context of means and ends, so means are things that you use to achieve your ends. And Rothbard defines them as features of the environment that you think you can alter in order to achieve your end. And then he contrasts them with just general conditions of action. So those are features of the environment that they're useful to you. You use them to achieve ends, but you can't really alter them. So a classic example for most practical purposes is the atmosphere, or the oxygen, or however you want to talk about that, the air that we're breathing. If you didn't have that, if that were lacking in our environment, if all of a sudden all the oxygen vanished, nobody would be able to achieve very many ends, at least for, not for more than a few minutes, right? Because we'd all die. But in most situations, we really have no control over that. Now, we do sometimes, like if you're going to be a deep sea diver, then the oxygen at your disposal is something you control, and therefore it would become a scarce economic means. But generally speaking, most people, everyday purposes, the ability to breathe is not something they even think about, because it's just there. So it's a background feature of the environment. And so that's what Rothbard is talking about there. So the means are the things that we can control and alter. And then that leads into this issue of scarcity and how we have to economize, because we can't achieve all of our ends. We can only achieve some of them. And so that's the whole reason for having economics, and the whole reason, the necessity of choice. Okay. I think this is consistent with what Rothbard was doing, but this is maybe coming at it from a slightly different angle. So I just want to make sure, in case you were getting lost, that you understand what his arguments were here. All right, so I'm calling these prerequisites of action. So one thing is, there has to be a subjective desire for improvement. Right? So if a person were totally content with the world, then there would be no reason for action. Right? Because the reason you act, the reason you have a goal, is because you want to achieve something. You want to improve the situation. Now, there's an interesting sort of philosophical worldview difference. In human action, Mises refers to this as there being felt uneasiness. And he's saying that people act to remove uneasiness, whereas Rothbard doesn't take a stand there. And so it's necessarily true that the person wants to improve the situation, but you could just as well say right now a person's ecstatic and he thinks, oh my gosh, this amazing life would be even better if I did such and such. Okay, so there it's a little bit weird to say he's trying to remove a felt uneasiness. Okay, so Mises is almost like real pessimistic. It's almost like people are walking around with all these burdens and woes and they're trying to just remove their pain, whereas Rothbard is more open-ended and saying, well, no, it's just you're trying to improve your situation as you perceive it. That's what you're doing with action. Okay, so anyway, that's just a little minor nuance there. But that first bullet point, that alone is not enough to get you action, okay? Because you also need the second bullet point. The person has to have a theory as to how to change the situation. So that's, it's going to involve means, right? Because those are the things that you can control by definition. Okay, so just because you are unhappy, or just because you can imagine being in a better position, if you had absolutely no idea as to how to make that transition, how to go from your current position or situation to the one that you're imagining, well, then you wouldn't act on that desire, right? Because what would you do? By hypothesis, we're saying you have no idea what you could do to make your situation better. So when we're describing something as an action, maybe this is the way to do it. Maybe we'll go at it, reverse engineer it. When you see something and you're describing it as an action, what you actually have in mind here is that the person had a goal in mind and had a theory as to how to make things better. So just give you a mundane example. You see this collection of cells that we call a human being manipulating muscles and bone and so forth to propel the body over to a table, you know, lift the arm and so forth using biceps and triceps, and then grab the cylinder that contains a bunch of liquid in it, unscrews the cap, tilts it back, and empties the liquid into first his mouth and then down the esophagus and into the stomach. And you ask a four-year-old, hey, what just happened there? He's going to say, oh, he just drank that water. And if you push him, you say, well, did he do it on purpose? And you say, well, yeah. And you say, why did he do it on purpose? Well, because he's thirsty. Okay, so and it, even there, though, technically there's one little aspect to it. So it's not enough, and it's just so automatic we don't even bother saying it, but strictly speaking there, we're describing that as an action, right? It's not reflex. It's not like if someone comes along and takes a hammer and hits your knee and your leg goes up. That's not human action. That's just a mindless reflex. Or if someone comes up and sprays your face with mace and, you know, you start tearing up, you're not choosing to have a watery, salty discharge from your eyes. That's just a, you know, a bodily reflex, okay? But if you walk up and grab a thing of water and drink it, that's a human action, right? Because we're going to say that's not just your body doing something automatically. Your mind is at work there. You are doing that on purpose. And so my point is there's a lot packed into that simple observation. So one thing is we could say, oh, well, you're thirsty, but there's more. There's one thing is you don't like being thirsty, or you would prefer to not be thirsty, right? Because if you get what I'm saying, I mean, I'm spelling this out and dragging it out, but I just want to make sure you guys see this point here. Strictly speaking, to say he drank that water because he's thirsty, that's a non sequitur. What if the person wants to be thirsty? What if I said to somebody, hey, if you die of thirst, I'll give your heirs $1 billion, and the person, you know, has cancer or something and he's going to die anyway in a month. And so he says, okay, well, then I'm just not going to drink anything and I'll die of thirst so my family gets $1 billion. You know, you can see, so it's not a given that people want to alleviate their thirst. They might not want to. Okay, so when you say, oh, he's drinking that water because he's thirsty, really what you mean is he subjectively prefers to not be thirsty, but there's still something else involved, that the person has a theory that says, if I drink this water, that will take away my thirst. Okay, and again, that's so obvious, you know, you don't even normally think about it, but for something that's not as obvious, it'd be more apparent that. So again, an action, we're going to label something as an action or interpret or classify something as an action. We're building in there a lot of things. One thing is that the person has a subjective preference and wants to change the situation. But another aspect of it is that the person has a theory as to how the world works and thinks, if I do this, then this, you know, future that I'm imagining will unfold. Just a little technicality here for those of you who are real eager beavers and overachievers. Strictly speaking, the person only has to think that his or her action will make it more likely that that outcome will occur. Okay, so because the way Rothbard talks about it in this first chapter, I forget his exact wording, but he makes it sound like you have to know if you do this action, then you will achieve your outcome, or you have to believe. And strictly speaking, you don't have to believe it's necessarily going to happen. You just need to think it's more likely that it'll happen. And the, you know, an obvious example of that would be if you're playing blackjack or something and you're trying to decide, do I want to double down on this next card? And a person interpreting that would say, yep, that's a purposeful action. Why? Well, because he wants to win money and he thinks. So there, you wouldn't say he thinks if he doubles down, he will win more money. Strictly speaking, if the person's a good card player, you would say he thinks if he doubles down, you know, the mathematical expectation of his winnings is now higher or something like that. Right? But it's not that you think for sure, oh, if I do this, then I'm going to be happier. You know, you might double down and get a 2 or something. Okay. Last bullet point on this is Rothbard is saying that their action, the way we perceive it or that we're talking about it in this course, necessarily relies on there being uncertainty about the future, right? So it's an interesting little twist that bullet point number 2, in a sense, is saying the person has to have some knowledge or some belief about how the world works and how the future will be. Because if you just had no idea whatsoever, right, if it were sort of an Alice in Wonderland times infinity type world in which up was down and nothing made any sense, you might not be able to act, right? Because you wouldn't know. Like, so if you were thirsty, you wouldn't know what to do, because maybe if I drink that thing, it'll make me even more thirsty, you know, because the world's so crazy, right? So there needs to be some idea. You need to have some recognition of how the world works and expectations about the future in order to act. So you had to have some knowledge, as it were. But on the other hand, you can't be omniscient. That if you are absolutely sure of what's going to happen in the future, well, then there's no point in acting, right? That it's unalterable. Okay, so here, this sort of gets into the joke about, you know, could you go and ask God who's going to win the World Series this year? And then if he tells you, well, then now God is powerless to make the other team win, right? Because, you know, he's God, so he's supposed to be right. So if he told you that one team's going to win, that has to come true because everything God says is true. But then, in a sense, that means God is now powerless to make the other team win, but God's supposed to be all-powerful. And so there's like a paradox. Okay, so that's – and Mises actually says in Human Action that the you know, the monotheistic tradition notions of God, it's a little bit tricky to apply the concept of human act or action to that sort of conception, because a being that is omniscient and omnipotent, there seems to be some tension there. Okay, so anyway, that's what Rothbard's getting at with this third bullet point, saying that if a human, you know, it's not just an empirical claim that a person can't know everything. Rothbard is saying that our notion of action really wouldn't work for a being that knew the entire future with certainty, because then that being couldn't alter the future. So that's the idea, that in a sense, the future right now is open-ended. Different things might happen depending on what we do. And so that's what gives us the motivation to act, because we think that we have some control over the course of events, but that we're not sure what's going to happen. And so that's why we act, to try to steer things in ways that we prefer. Okay. So now let's move on to some implications of action. So here, let me just again be clear about what the argument is. We're saying that this idea, that this concept of people acting, and once you spell it out, you know, it seems pretty obvious, and it's not like, well, actually, some people would object to it. There are certain behaviorists and others that think what we're calling action is an illusion. They're saying, no, people don't have minds. It's just all genetic, or it's all reinforced behavior, reward and punishment, whatever, however you want to talk about it, but conditioned behavior. And they think that it's an illusion that people act in the Misesian sense. Okay, so some people do think that. Most social scientists would stipulate, okay, yeah, sure, people act, but who cares, big deal. But actually, you can derive a lot of what we recognize as principles of basic economic theory just from this observation or this axiom that people act, that they engage in purposeful behavior. Okay, so again, here, what we're doing is we're going to say, once you get the concept of action in the sense of Mises, look at all these things that sort of are packed in there that we can derive from it, right? So if you know geometry, just for an analogy, what we're doing is it's like we proved one thing, we proved some theorem, and now we're showing corollaries of it. We're showing things that if you accept that theorem is true, look at all these other things that pop out of it. Okay, so that's what we're doing here. Okay, so one implication is that only individuals act. So the idea is, and here I'm hitting all the points Rothbard did, but I'm trying to say it in different words so that if you've read it, maybe it'll snap with you and you'll see it on this version if you didn't get it with Rothbard's. So the idea is, look, when I say that somebody is acting, if I say I just saw action, well, then there has to be an actor. Okay, so you see what I'm, this isn't a matter of, oh, there's action, and then now I'm going to use further empirical investigation. Oh, hey, look at 10 times out of 10 where I saw action, there was also an actor involved. No, you're missing the point. If you're going to talk about purposeful behavior, there must be some entity that has the purpose. Okay? If you're going to look at something and say there is, that's goal-seeking behavior, there must be something seeking the goal. Okay, so you can see how it's packed right into the concept of action itself. All right, and so one thing is that it's only individuals act. The best way to illustrate this is just to say, a lot of times people speak loosely and they'll say things like, oh, the United States joined World War II in 1941. And then the United States went and started attacking Japanese naval vessels. But no, the United States didn't do anything. All right. It's, or rather, you can more accurately unpack that and say specifically, it was various individuals in the United States government who made decisions and so on and so forth. Okay. And then they gave orders, and then pilots were flying, you know, fighter aircraft and bombers taking off from U.S. warships that drop bombs on people, but it was ultimately individuals pressing the buttons to drop the bombs and so on. Okay, so that's where Rothbard's coming from there. And let me just, because this gets confusing, a lot of people misunderstand this point. To say this does not mean that we're, that Austrian economists deny the importance of what you might call mob psychology. Okay, so it's, to say only individuals act, that's just a statement about the unit of analysis. All right, so it could be entirely true and a valid point that a psychologist or a criminologist or a sociologist might make to say, look at, those people were outraged in a small town somewhere that this guy, that they, it was a drifter, and then all of a sudden, you know, a bunch of people turned up dead, and the crowd formed, and this angry lynch mob formed, and they assumed it was the drifter, and they didn't give him a fair trial, and they just grabbed him and hanged him from a tree and killed him, okay? And you might say, you know, how did that happen? You know, these people are normally law-abiding citizens and so on. Well, what happened? And it might be perfectly correct to say, well, it's because they were in a big crowd and people got them all riled up and, you know, they were drinking and, you know, they just got angry. And then one guy started doing it and people all did something as a mob that they would never in a million years have done individually. Okay. And that's perfectly fine. But the point is, you don't say, oh, no individual hanged that guy, the crowd did it. That's not true. That no, in order for that noose to get around the guy's neck, somebody had to hold him and somebody else tied it and somebody else. So those people were using means to achieve ends. Now, it's true, you could say their ends were different in that environment with the angry mob than they would have been had the person been by himself. Okay, so that's true. But the point is, the crowd per se doesn't do stuff. It's the individuals in the crowd that do something. And so whenever you use language like that, you can decompose it and just say, well, what do we mean? And actually, it's individuals doing things, at least if we're talking about action, because again, action presupposes that there's an actor, and that's an individualistic concept. Okay, so another thing that's baked right into it, and I got into a little bit of this with the the example of the guy drinking water, is that individuals have preferences. Because again, if you're going to start describing something as an action, that language only makes sense if you assume the actor has goals or preferences. Because to say, oh, I'm interpreting what just happened as somebody trying to achieve a goal, well, then you necessarily are saying the person wants to achieve the goal as opposed to failing to achieve it. You know, the person has a preference, right? So again, it's almost so obvious it's not worth spelling out, but we are spelling it out because I want to make sure you get this point. So again, this, it's not that we're separately observing. It's not that we say, oh, here's some action. And then you know what? A lot of times when I see action, it's also the case that the person involved has preferences. But no, if you're going to call something an action, then you're automatically attributing preferences to the person. They might not be your preferences, but the point is you're attributing preferences. And if you're not, then it's not an action. So we don't say that, the reason that the temperatures go up during the summer, we don't say, oh, it's because the earth wants to get warmer and so it tilts toward the sun. We don't talk like that, okay? And so we don't attribute preferences to the earth or to the sun when we're explaining seasonal temperatures, but by the same token, we're not calling it an action. Okay, so if we're saying something is an action in the Misesian Rothbardian sense, we necessarily are attributing preferences to the actor. All right, so another thing that flows right through there is that preferences are subjective, meaning they are associated with the actor. That when you're talking about action, the preferences are not, at least not necessarily, some universal thing. So we're not, you know, from the action observation itself. Okay, so in case you're, so this slide, I'm saying people have different preferences. Some people like Sinatra, some people like Carrot Top, and so forth. So if somebody's drinking the water, and we're going to interpret that as an action. And okay, so let's say there's a POW camp, and the prisoners are in there, and the guards are, you know, saying, okay, and the prisoners are thirsty, and the guards say, you better give us the information we want, and the prisoners say, nope, we're not going to tell you, and, to, you know, it's going a long time, and the prisoners are really thirsty, and then the guards try a different approach, the interrogators, and they put out a bottle of water, and say, there you go, you know, don't you want some, and then one prisoner just gulps it down, and the other one, you know, spits at the guard and says, I don't want your stinking water. Okay, so how are we going to explain? We can explain both of those things as actions. We could say, well, the first guy was really thirsty and he wanted the water and he knew if he drank the water, it would make him feel better. So that's why he did that. And the second guy, that was an action too. Yep, he is thirsty, but it was more important to him to spite the guard and not to take the guard's generosity because he, you know, is really against what the guard's doing. He doesn't want to give the guard the satisfaction of looking weak and having taken the gift of water. Okay, so I'm explaining both of those behaviors of their bodily movements in terms of action, but in order to do that, I had to talk about their preferences, and they had different ones. The first guy preferred to satisfy his thirst, even though, you know, it would, in a sense, look weak to the guard, and the other guy, it was more important to him to not accept something from the guard than to satisfy his thirst. Okay, and then, and this is a real big one for Austrian economics, another thing we can get just from the concept of action itself is that preferences are a ranking. So this is really tricky for some people, and we'll come back to this a lot more carefully later on in this course when we start talking about barter and how prices are formed. But for our purposes right now, let me just point out to you that you can't get a measurement, what's called a cardinal measurement, of utility or of happiness or satisfaction from action itself. Okay, if you want to come up with a theory of that stuff, you can, but you're not deriving it from action. The only thing you can derive from action per se is that people have subjective preferences, and they form a ranking. Okay, because the only thing you can do when someone acts, all a person can demonstrate is that he prefers one thing over another. Okay, so if you're look, just take that example I was working with there, the POW camp. All we can conclude is the guy who drank the water preferred, you know, it was more important to him to satisfy his thirst than to spike the guard. Okay, so satisfying his thirst was higher up on his scale of values or his ranking of important things or goals than, you know, spiting that guard. Whereas for the other guy, what did we observe? We conclude, oh, it was more important to him to spite the guard than to satisfy his thirst. But we couldn't, from their actions, deduce and say, oh, that first guy, you know, it was 38% more important for him, or he got 38% more utility from drinking the water than from spiting the guard. And for the other guy, he got 18% more utility or more status. You couldn't talk like that just from observing their action. Because when you act, all you're doing is you're choosing one thing and you're refraining from other things. Okay, so that's why preferences are a ranking in the Austrian tradition. And again, when we go on later, we'll see this more specifically, and Rothbard really gets into the nitty-gritty about halfway through the book, comparing Austrian economics with mainstream stuff. But for right now, I just want to point out, from action itself, you can derive this fact that preferences are a ranking. You cannot derive what's called cardinal utility, where you're doing intensities of desire. Okay, just to go over some of the classification schemes that you're going to see in this first half of the chapter. So you can divide all goods into two broad categories. You got producer goods, which are also called the means of production. They're also called factors of production. So those terms are basically interchangeable. Producer goods, means of production, and I don't have it written here, but factors of production. Those three terms are basically interchangeable. You might see them used by Roth different places. So that's one thing. And then you've got consumer goods. All right, so consumer goods are those that directly satisfy our goals or our ends. So all the goods are means, but the consumer goods are the ones that directly satisfy whatever our objectives are. Whereas producer goods, they're not directly useful. They're only useful because they help us create consumer goods. Okay, so an apple for most people is going to be a consumer good because it can directly alleviate hunger, right? You just eat the apple and there you go. Whereas an apple seed for most people is going to be a producer good because it doesn't, if you're hungry, you're not going to want to start eating apple seeds probably. But and if you're a person who needs food, most of us do, an apple seed's not useless to you. You're not going to just throw it out. You're going to economize on it. You're going to use it because, you know, if you plant it and so on and so forth, it's going to eventually produce a bunch of apples, which are useful to you. Okay, so the producer goods derive their value from the consumer goods. All right, we value producer goods because we value consumer goods and because we have theories that suggest to us that, oh, we can use these producer goods to create or to produce consumer goods. Okay, so within the class of producer goods, there's three main categories. You've got what used to be called land, and now we call them natural resources because that's a more accurate term, right? So we say land, we don't just mean the real estate, okay? By land, typically what we mean are the gifts of nature. So that would include, yes, real estate, but also, you know, rivers and streams and the fish that are in the ocean and mineral deposits, gold, copper deposits, that kind of stuff. Labor, of course, is the factor of production that's the human body and the actions performed by human body or by human. And then capital goods, those are means of production that human beings have previously produced. Okay, so that's what a capital good is. And the other note I have on this slide is that consumer goods, strictly speaking, to clear up some thorny issues elsewhere in economic theory, it helps if we define leisure as a consumer good. Okay, leisure meaning, using your time for recreation, using your body just for recreational purposes, that you're not using your body to achieve some other end. Okay, because when you're laboring, when you're working, you're using your body, but you're not doing it for the direct benefits of whatever it is you're doing it indirectly. That you're doing it because you know, as a result of my work, I'm going to create products or services that will indirectly, then benefit me. But it's not, if you're working on a drill press, that per se is not enjoyable to you. Whereas if you're going downhill skiing, that per se is enjoyable to you. You're not saying, well, gee, what's the point of doing that? That is the point. You're doing it because it's fun. But if we say, why is somebody sweating for 8 hours a day in this factory? It's because the person, is going to get paid, and he knows if I do that, I'll get paid, and then I'll go be able to buy stuff with it. So there, it's a means to an end. Okay, but incidentally, just to warn you guys, I can hear my office mate has the TV on. There are tornado watches or warnings. I don't know what the status is. So anyway, it's conceivable you'll see me get sucked away, and that'll be the coolest video ever, or that my connection will go off, more likely. But hopefully, nothing like that will happen. Okay, just got a few more slides here, and then I'll turn over to your questions. So in the slide I just went over with production, with producer goods and consumer goods, that's fairly standard stuff. Okay, that's most economists would subscribe to that or to some version of it. But what I'm doing right here, this is specifically Austrian. All right, so I don't know if you can read it. It's kind of overlapping the bottom of the chalkboard on the slide. They say they're Mengerian hierarchy of goods, meaning it's following Karl Menger, the founder, the pioneer of Austrian economics. So in his framework, the way he conceived of things is you have your first order goods or lowest order, and those are the consumer goods. And then you've got the higher order goods. So the second order goods are the land, labor, and capital that you use to produce the first order goods. And then the third order goods are the factors of production that you use to produce the second order goods, and so on. Okay, so that's the way Menger classified goods. And later on, we're not going to get to it in this course, but if you stick around with me when we go over what's called Austrian business cycle theory, you'll see that this stuff is really important, that the Austrian business cycle theory uses this concept of the various orders of goods to explain how things get screwed up when the central bank tinkers with interest rates. Okay, but for our purposes right now, just you need to know consumer goods are the lowest order, and then the higher order goods are classified in the relationship to the overall plan. So notice here, it's not all these classifications, they're ultimately due to the subjective plans of the individual. Okay, the individual that's engaging in the action has a plan in mind, has a set of goals or what have you, and then is going to use the environment and use those features of the environment that the individual thinks he can alter. And those are the means, and so that's where goods come from, the idea of goods. Okay, so the individual surveys the landscape and decides certain things he can alter in order to achieve his goals or to make the achievement of his goals more likely than would otherwise be the case. And that's what makes things into goods. Okay, so these classifications are actually a subjective thing. They're not an objective thing. Excuse me. Just let me give you a couple examples so you know what I mean. If a guy's on a street corner playing a guitar and he's just doing it because he's just, killing time and he likes the tune or the melody, whatever, and do-do-do, he's just playing guitar, you say, what is that guitar to him? Is it a consumer good or is it a producer good? We'd say, why are you doing that, sir? And if he says, well, it's just because I think it sounds nice. Well, then it's a consumer good. He's deriving pleasure from playing it. He's doing it for its own sake. So that guitar to that guy is a consumer good. But then, you know, he starts getting really good, and he notices if he puts a hat out or a box out that people walking by sometimes will throw in money because he's playing. Well, now that guitar, even though it's the same physical thing, it has the same physical properties and acoustic properties and so forth, now all of a sudden it might be a producer good, because now the way the guy is looking at it, the way he's interpreting it, integrating it into his actions, he's using it as a means to generate income, whereas before it was just something that was going to generate enjoyment for him. Okay, so that's just one simple example of how the same physical thing can switch what it is because of the different plans of the people using it. Okay, so that's, to just be clear there, that when we're talking about classification of goods, it's not because of their objective properties. Now, obviously, with all this stuff, it's not that we're, I don't even know what the term is. It's not that we think that the world isn't real, okay? That we're all just imagining everything and nothing is real. It's all in your head, man. That's not what we're saying. Obviously, if someone came along and cut the wire or the strings, maybe it would no longer be a producer, but maybe it'd be trash or something, okay? But the physical properties of the guitar are obviously relevant, but my point is, what defines the guitar as a producer or a consumer good is you have to know how is some acting person looking at that thing and using it in his own framework, mental framework, as to how am I going to approach the world? Can I use this thing and how can I use it? Right. So yeah, the thing's physical properties are important for how a person's going to end up using it, but it's not the properties themselves that are the definition or the criteria of what makes it a producer good, a second order good, a third order good, and so forth. Okay, the role of time. This will come up later. Rothbard will talk about this in more detail later on. For our purposes right now, he makes two main points that I want to reiterate. So one is that is what's called time preference. So that what that means is that other things equal, a person prefers a satisfaction to be achieved sooner rather than later. And so this gets into tricky territory if you really want to delve into this stuff. But that's just, at least you have to know what Rothbard means by that. Okay, so it doesn't mean you always want everything right away. You don't ever want to wait. But the point is there has to be some counterbalancing advantage to waiting. All right. So if you say to somebody, hey, I have a bunch of fireworks, do you want to watch me blow them up tonight, or do you want to wait till July 4th? And the person says, oh, I want to wait till July 4th. That's not a violation of the law of time preference. Rothbard would just say, well, no, other things aren't equal there. That the enjoyment from watching the fireworks show is heightened if you know that it's the holiday and other people are doing it too in July 4th rather than doing it right now. Okay, but Rothbard is saying the same satisfaction, the same enjoyment, other things equal, people always want to enjoy it sooner rather than later. And that's what time preference is. And that will, when we talk about interest, that's where this concept's going to be crucial. That's how the Austrians, at least in the tradition of Mises, understand what interest is. Interest meaning like interest rate, it's like interest rate of 5%, 4%. That's what I'm talking about. So to understand that, once we get to that part of the course, this issue of time preference is crucial. The other thing Rothbard says is that other things equal, people prefer goods that yield, that are more durable, that yield a flow of services over a longer period of time. And this is pretty obvious that, you know, if you're going to have a house, other things equal, you would prefer the house last 100 years rather than lasting 2 minutes. Okay, so you can come up with all sorts of scenarios where maybe that's not true, but you would always see that there was some other thing that wasn't equal. That was, you know, because really when it comes down to it, all Rothbard is saying is you would prefer more of a good than less. And if something is a good, then that's true. Okay, and then I think this is the last, right, yeah. So this is the last slide I have. I'm a little bit over time here. Let me just spend 5 minutes or so on this last topic because it's fairly important, and then I'll turn over your questions. So at the end of the section we were supposed to read for tonight, we're talking about marginal utility and got into diminishing marginal utility. So let me just give you the big picture first, and then we'll hit on some of the controversial points. So when people, and this is not a uniquely Austrian point, this is modern economics. This is what was called the subjectivist or marginalist revolution that was ushered in the 1870s. Okay, so just so you know, even mainstream economists, when they study the history of economic thought, they will come across the name Karl Menger because he is one of three economists who is credited with this insight of marginal utility. So the idea is, and the reason I have this slide is this goes back to what's called the water diamond paradox. So the best way to get this across with the time we have available is I'll just talk about the paradox and the solution. Okay, so the classical economists, they're not stupid. They understand, by classical economists, I mean people before the marginal revolution. I mean like Adam Smith, David Hume, people like that. They understood that goods were valued because of people's preferences, people's subjective needs and desires. Okay, so they understood that it wasn't just some random thing that goods were valuable in the marketplace because they, you know, attracted more sunlight or something, or you know, that wasn't why it all could be explained by reference to people's desires for what they could use those things for. Right, so that word utility has to do with usefulness, right? So goods were valued because they were useful to people. Okay, so even, you know, classical economists knew that, but there was this issue that it seemed a little bit odd, and it's not even that the classical economists couldn't explain this, it's just their framework was very clumsy. And so again, when people teach this, a lot of times we come off as if Adam Smith was totally stumped by this and he didn't know what to do, and that's not really accurate. I mean, he knew the answer, it's just he kind of had to deviate from their general framework they would use to explain this particular issue. And so that Menger and Jevons and Walras, the people who introduced marginal utility analysis, their framework could handle this effortlessly. So that's the idea. Okay, so the paradox is, the water diamond paradox is, look at, if goods are valued because of their usefulness to people, well then why wouldn't a unit of water have a really high price in the market, much higher than a diamond, let's say, because water is essential for life, whereas diamonds, they're pretty to look at, but they don't really do anything for us. We put them on jewelry and stuff, you know, we just look at them and we derive pleasure from seeing the light bounce off them. But, you know, if diamonds disappeared tomorrow, it wouldn't be a big deal. If water disappeared tomorrow, we'd all die. So if we're gonna, as economists, explain the usefulness, or sorry, the market value of goods by reference to their usefulness to people, why isn't water one of the most expensive things around? So that's the water diamond paradox. So the solution is that when we engage in action, we're not choosing between the entire stock of one good versus another. We're always choosing over specific units of it. And so we're choosing on the margin, the marginal unit. So if you don't know why we're using that term here, just think of, on a book, where are the margins? Well, they're at the edges, right? So that's the idea here. If you're thinking of, you have a bunch of water, you have 100 gallons of water, the marginal unit is the hundredth gallon. It's the one on the edge of your supply. that's where the, you know, mnemonic to remember this term margin in this context. Okay, so if you're trying to decide, you know, if someone offers you a choice, someone walks up to you and says, okay, you can choose, I can give you a pound of diamonds or a pound of water, what do you want? Just about everybody in most circumstances is going to say, I'll take the pound of diamonds. And the reason is that on the margin, the usefulness of a pound of diamonds is a lot higher to you than the usefulness of a pound of water. And I'm saying pound just to make sure that the units are the same. Okay, so that's what's going on. So the we're trying to explain market prices. Everything fits. It's correct to say, yeah, market prices are determined or influenced by the usefulness of the goods, but the usefulness of the marginal goods. So the reason a bottle of water is much less expensive than a comparable weight or volume of diamonds is that for most people, that particular bottle of water, that unit of it, isn't that big a deal. So think of it this way. The person, you take a standard person, he has a bunch of goals and preferences, subjective value scale, and you start adding bottles of water to his possession. You know, the first few bottles that he gets from you are going to be very valuable. We would say their marginal utility is really high because he's going to, if he doesn't have any water at all, he's going to die of thirst pretty soon. If you give him a few gallons, well, now he's not going to die of thirst. So those first few units of water are incredibly valuable because they mean the difference between life and death. But then you keep giving him more and more bottles of water or more units of water, and then the usefulness of that marginal unit starts going down. Because, like, after the guy's got 50 gallons of water, he's, well, I can't drink that much even the next few weeks. You start giving him more access to more and more gallons of water. He said, we're going to do it. He said, well, I can start bathing with this. So that's good, you know, because it's important to him to not be dirty and smelly. But you keep adding, he said, okay, well, I can water my lawn with this. And so you see how now the 200th gallon of water isn't very important to him. Because the way you figure out its importance is you say, if I were to take this away, and then you had to economize with now only 199 units of water, what would you do? The end that he's going to sacrifice is going to be the end that was least important to him that could be satisfied with that 200th gallon. Okay, so it's going to, you know, the 200th gallon has some value to him because there is an end that he can satisfy with 200 gallons that he can't satisfy with 199. Maybe it's, you know, washing the window on his car or something. And he values that. So he does value it, but it's not nearly as important to him as not dying of thirst. Okay, so that's the point, that when you start taking units away from somebody, the goal that they may take the hit is the goal that's least important to them that was being satisfied by those things. Okay, so that's the discussion. And Rothbard talks about animals and things like that. That's what he's getting at there. The point is, when you start taking away units of somebody's supply of a good or stockpile of a good, they rearrange how they're using the remaining units to satisfy their most important wants that type of good can satisfy with the now diminished supply. So you're always sacrificing the thing that's least important to you. And so that is, if you get how that works, now you should understand the law of diminishing marginal utility. Because going the other way now, if you start adding more and more units, a person is going to, you know, each subsequent unit, a person's going to devote to satisfying an end that was less important than the previous one. Okay, so for with the water, you know, you keep moving along, wash your car, you water your lawn so it's green and not brown. Okay, keep going. And, you know, keep going, oh, well, now maybe you'll let your kid, you know, turn on the sprinkler and run through the sprinkler or put those slide in the backyard that, you know, you run and jump on and so forth and slide through. So the more and more water you're having access to, you're allocating it to ends that are less and less important to you. And so that's why the marginal utility of water is going to go down the more units you have access to as your supply or your stockpile increases. Okay, so that's what the law of diminishing marginal utility is. And so notice that's not an empirical observation. It's not that we surveyed a bunch of people in the real world and said, you know what, every time we've looked, it seems that people, when they get access to more units of a good, allocate those extra units to the most important end that has not yet been satisfied, but which is less important than the previously satisfied ends. That's not an empirical observation. That just follows from what it means for an end to be important to you. It's almost like, not by definition, but by implication, if you have 5 units and I give you one more and then you satisfy some other thing, that thing that you just satisfied with the 6th unit has to be less important to you than the things you satisfied with the first 5 units. Because if it were more important, then why did you wait? You would have done it earlier. Okay? That's what it means for us to interpret your behavior, your actions, and say those other things were more important to you. What we mean is you would take care of them first rather than these subsequent things. Okay, so that's why this is not an empirical observation. This is, it follows from the action axiom itself. If you just think through the logical implications of it. Okay, let me just take one more minute. So on this so-called law of diminishing marginal utility, there is a slight issue. You can have this wrinkle where what happens if, I'm trying to think of a good example. Let's say somebody likes omelets. Okay, let's say for some reason somebody hates eggs per se, like scrambled eggs, they don't like it, but they really like an omelet, but there needs to be 3 eggs to really make a good omelet. Okay, and so you can imagine where the person, you know, you say, if you just had 1 egg, what would you do with it? He's like, I guess I'd fry it, but I really don't like a fried egg. What if you had 2 eggs? Well, I'd have 2 fried eggs. I really like. What if I gave you 3 eggs? Oh, well, then I would make my omelet with my bell peppers and with my onions and my cheese. Oh, that'd be awesome. I would love to get that 3rd egg to make my omelet. Okay, so there, if you get into situations like there, where what technically what's happening is, if there's an end that can be satisfied with that type of good, but you need a sufficient number of units in order to get like the first dosage of the end you're going for, that's what causes these little wrinkles. Or if you have a car, you might say, if I just have 1 tire, that's useless to me. If I have 2 tires, that's useless. If I have 3 tires, that's useless. But whoa, you give me 4 tires, now we're talking. And so so the logic that we use to prove diminishing marginal utility is a little bit weird in situations like that. So the way Rothbard handles that is he just says, well, you're using the wrong unit then. That when we're thinking through the law of diminishing marginal utility, the unit size has to be such that getting extra doses of it allows you to achieve discrete units of what you're trying to satisfy. And so if you need 3 eggs to make an omelet, well, then don't choose 1 egg as your unit, choose 3 eggs. And then it would be true that the first batch of 3 eggs are more important to you than the second batch of 3 eggs, because that first omelet is more important to you than the second omelet, that kind of stuff. Okay, so that's the way Rothbard handles that sort of complication. Okay, so let me stop there. I will now switch to your questions. So again, for those of you who are new to this, it would get way too complicated if I tried to, in real time, field your questions. So that's why we have the questions for the professor in Moodle, oops, which I should have opened beforehand and I forgot. Okay, almost there. Okay. I'm trying, sorry, but I'm trying to find questions that are sort of open-ended. All right, let's try this one. Okay, so Naju writes, I think Rothbard should have skipped the alterable versus non-alterable distinction between means and general conditions on page 4 and gone straight to the means are the action requirements which must be economized definition on page 5. I don't think the alterability matters much. If I light a fire, I will be altering my environment, burning oxygen, etc. However, the point is that I don't care as long as I have enough oxygen units to achieve all my ends. Oxygen in this scenario is not a means, it is a non-scarce resource. Now, if the number of available units decrease to the point where I need to economize, then I need to include it in my means-end analysis. Okay, yeah, so I think I get what you're saying. Nedju is saying that, strictly speaking, it's Rothbard's acting as if it's the same thing to say something is a background condition or that it's alterable versus non-alterable. And you're saying, well, no, you could alter something, but as long as your alteration wasn't changing its relevance for your needs or your desires, then what's the big deal? Fair enough, but what Rothbard means is he's saying you're not altering the fact that it can satisfy your objectives. All right, so it's I get what you're saying, and I think Rothbard would agree with you. He would just say the way he's using the term, you know, what is it that's being altered? He would say you're not able to alter its usefulness to you. You're not going to be able to extinguish it. And so that's, if that is not alterable by you, then it is indeed a background feature of the environment that doesn't need to be economized. Okay. Let's see. Okay, Naju also says, I've read that some Austrians don't think time preference is a conceptual law of action, but an empirical regularity. I think Kirzner thinks this. Can you point us to more recent papers, books that elaborate on time preference? Actually, my dissertation was on this. And so, yeah, that's, I have a bunch of references in there. I don't want to go get it right now because it'll slow me down, but if you just Google Robert P. Murphy dissertation, I think it'll come up. The title of it is, what the heck is the title of my dissertation? Wow, that's embarrassing. I'm blanking out. If you type a Robert Murphy dissertation, I think it'll come up. Unanticipated intertemporal change in theories of interest. I think that's what the title is. It's a very opaque definition. But anyway, as far as your question goes, you're exactly right that there is a lot of controversy. So Mises, one of his big defining characteristics, the thing that sets Mises apart from a lot of other economists, is this focus on what's called a priori. Okay, that he thinks that, look, it's not that we need to go test economic laws. We just derive them from the action axiom, the way that people in geometry derive theorems from their axioms and postulates. Okay, so a lot of mainstream economists now think that that's goofy. They think, what are you talking about? What are you, some medieval scholastic? Why don't you get scientific, man? Get in the 20th century. But so on that issue, Mises thinks that time preference, the fact that people prefer satisfaction sooner rather than later, Mises thinks that's what we need to know to understand the phenomenon of interest, like interest rates and why are interest rates high or low, that kind of thing. But he doesn't want to just leave it up in the air. He wants to say, no, this issue of time preference is not just that we say, hey, you know, I've noticed in my observations of people that they tend to want to get stuff now rather than wait for it. That Mises doesn't think that's solid enough. He says, no, to really ground this, to make it part of praxeology, we need to be able to deduce it the same way I can deduce the law of diminishing marginal utility. I don't just want to empirically look out and see that people value subsequent units less than earlier units. I want to be able to deduce that. So it's the same thing with time preference. Mises and Rothbard and a lot of, I would say most modern Misesians agree with them. is he says, let me just give you a quick example of how Mises tries to prove it. So he says, look, it has to be the case that somebody prefers to achieve a given satisfaction sooner rather than later. He says, because suppose the person didn't. Suppose someone really didn't mind whether he got to achieve a satisfaction today versus postponing it and achieving it tomorrow. So Mises says, if in that case, then the person might say, I'll wait till tomorrow. Now we hold everything else equal and we let a day pass. And now we present the person with the same alternative. We say, hey, do you want to consume today or do you want to wait one more day? And so if we hold the person's preferences the same, then the person's going to say, no, I don't care. And so Mises says, well, you could just keep doing that. And so Mises says that, if it weren't true that other things equal, people prefer a given satisfaction sooner rather than later, then they would be indifferent to indefinite postponement. But that's logically equivalent to saying they don't want to consume the thing at all. If you're just as happy to consume it today versus never consuming it, then is that thing really a good to you? Is it really a satisfaction? Okay, so that's where Mises is saying that. So his argument there is, if you tell me that you value something, that it's a good to you, that it's a satisfaction that you want to achieve, packed into that statement, you're necessarily implying that other thing, holding everything else equal, you want to achieve it sooner rather than later. And that's what I mean by time preference. Okay, so that's the type of argument Mises uses in Human Action to logically establish the existence of time preference. So you're right, Neju, that Israel Kirzner doesn't endorse that argument. And I asked him at NYU, because I was working on my dissertation and Kirzner was there, and I had this big critique of that stuff. So for this class, obviously you guys don't need to know that. You just need to know what Rothbard's views are. But I personally had some problems with Mises' arguments, and I wrote this, you know, rip-roaring refutation, you know, a lot of pages, and I was real sarcastic and everything, all these hypothetical examples. And I thought I blew up Mises, and I gave it to Kirzner, you know, wanting him to say, yep, you're right, Bob. And he didn't really have a dog in the fight. He just kind of said, people have time preference, and we just observe it. And I never understood Mises. I didn't know what he was doing in these sections of the book. Okay, so he just meant he didn't get what Mises' arguments for the a priori truth of time preference. He didn't really get the argument, and so he couldn't tell me whether my refutation was valid or not, because he admitted I never really understood what Mises was doing there. Kirzner just thought, what's the big deal? We know time preference is true empirically, if for no other reason that people are going to die, right? So you wouldn't in practice be willing to postpone consumption forever because you're going to die biologically. So Kirzner thought, who cares? You know, we don't need to worry about some disembodied will and holding the rest of the universe constant as time passes. I mean, that's nonsensical. Who cares about that? He just thought people care about the timing of stuff and they prefer to consume sooner rather than later. They're impatient, if you will. And that's how we explain positive interest rates. End of story. Who cares whether we can, you know, philosophically say that it's true by necessity? Who cares? Okay. I think we got time for one more question. And then, like I say, I will come back and fill in the stuff that I haven't answered today. Okay. Let's see. Okay, Brian Hauser says, Rothbard uses the example of making and eating a ham sandwich to demonstrate consumer versus producer goods. He says the ham sandwich at the point of being eaten is a consumer good, but can it also be viewed as a producer good since eating it will be providing fuel for future labor toward the production of other goods? Right, that's a good point, Brian, and yes, it can be. So again, it's not the physical attributes of the good. It always goes back to how is it being appraised or interpreted by the actor, him or herself. So if there's an athlete who's getting, you know, a boxer who's getting ready for a heavyweight fight, a prize title fight, and he's, you know, eating or drinking protein shakes and eating cottage cheese all day and, you know, just eating lean chicken and stuff like that, drinking a ton of water, while he's working out day in, day out of the gym and, you know, sparring and so forth, that person might not be looking at the protein shake as a consumer good. He might be looking at purely as a means to, you know, transforming his body to get ready for the fight that's going to happen in 6 months. Okay. Whereas somebody who, you know, his girlfriend just broke up with him and he's feeling really down in the dumps and he goes and gets some Häagen-Dazs and sits in front of the TV and starts watching, you know, sappy movies, eating the Häagen-Dazs, you know, there, that is presumably a consumer good to him because it's helping to alleviate his sadness, or he thinks it will. Okay. So he's eating it for the pleasure to take away his pain. Okay. So yeah, to answer your question, that is true. And also, things can be serving multiple purposes at the same time. So you could say if someone's eating the ham sandwich and really likes the taste of it, but also is using it as a means to not starve to death and because he wants to work more, then yeah, I mean, you could go, things can be various, a consumer good or a producer good in different types of plans depending on your framework. So that's certainly true as well. Okay, well, I think we're at the stop time here, and thanks everyone for tuning in. So remember, I will send out a notice through Moodle telling you exactly when the office hours will be this week. And also remember, if you're taking the class for credit, within the next day or two, the multiple choice quiz will become available. So again, I'll send out an email. I'll do it all in one email to not overwhelm your inbox, but I'll let you know when that's ready to go as well. Okay, remember to do your reading for next time, and I'll see you then. So Danny, I'll just wait for you to wrest control of this back from me, since I don't want to mess anything up. Oh, okay. Okay, so I can go ahead and log out. Okay. Thank you, everyone. So I don't need to save any of this stuff, right? Okay. Okay. All right. Great. Yeah, well, I just went to click out and it said save event files. Would you like to save the following? The share documents, chat, Q&A. Okay, so yeah, I'd rather just have you deal with that stuff. Okay, so I'm not going to save it. All right.